This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy and Rudy Giuliani appearing on Lou Dobbs yesterday, addressing the Michigan certification, the vote to certification of the Michigan results, but also, first and foremost, the apparent split with Sidney Powell on the legal team, which seems to be embroiled in some controversy.
Well, I think it's because we're pursuing two different theories. Our theory of the case to get to the Supreme Court, now in four places, and it's soon going to be in two others, and there'll be an overall lawsuit, is misconduct of the election by state officials in at least five or six different states, in which the misconduct of the election involved deprivation of constitutional rights for the president. And, for example, in one part of the state, you could fix a ballot, Democrat part. Other part of the state, you couldn't fix a ballot. One part of the state, the ballots were examined. Another part of the state, they didn't care if the ballots were examined. In Pennsylvania, there are 680,000 unexamined ballots that virtually were put in secretly by Democrats alone. That's outrageous. That is misconduct of the election. Elections are supposed to be conducted under the auspices of the laws passed by the legislature. And in fact, they made a mockery of it in Pennsylvania. The only place maybe worse is Michigan, and particularly the city of Detroit. The city of Detroit probably had more voters than it had citizens. I'm exaggerating a bit, but all you have to do is look at statistical data, and you can see that the fraud was rampant and out of control.
Yeah, well, sort of glossing over quickly the Sidney Powell thing, understandably so. I mean, there's certain things about the Trump legal team that are problematic, including Rudy, even though Rudy is over the target when he's talking about constitutional issues and using Pennsylvania as the example where I think the constitutional issues are most pronounced. But Wayne County, there were 878,000 people who voted out of 1.4 million registered voters.
Wow.
They made a mistake, as our friend John Hindraker and his fellows over at Powerline Blog noted end of last week, that an affidavit submitted in Lynn Wood's lawsuit claimed that 19 precincts had higher than 100% turnout in Michigan because they compared turnout numbers for precincts in Minnesota communities to the voter registration numbers for precincts in Michigan. They made a sloppy, really inexcusable mistake in the court filing. And so, again, there's the issue of legitimate constitutional issues to raise with respect to the administration of elections in certain states. And there's also the legitimate issue to raise of how competent Trump's legal team has been since November 3rd. And there was a report out yesterday. I think it was NBC News. I mean, again, citing anonymous sources, so take it for what it is. But it doesn't strain the bounds of credulity that Trump is pretty upset with his legal team in general because he thinks they're not making him look too good. I think that would be fair if he did believe that.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, it's not looking good at all. I mean, even today, the GSA approves Biden to begin his transition. But back to what you're talking about, still, the fact that Sidney Powell was on the team, she's off the team. It's a bit of a hot mess, and it is embarrassing. And I think that, you know, I mean, honestly, Dan, President Trump has lost 27 cases challenging the results of his election so far.
Yeah, that's you know, it actually is sort of a problem. It's not really a problem. He also got expedited appeal to the Third Circuit, the Third Circuit Court of Appeals yesterday for Pennsylvania. I mean, this is always trying to get to the Supreme Court. That's what's always been. Some of these lower court rulings are, frankly, largely irrelevant. Also, the press corps is conflating actions brought by individuals outside of the Trump campaign with actions brought by the actual Trump campaign legal team. All this sort of scorekeeping. You know, Jenna Ellis actually made a good point yesterday on MSNBC. Well, you'll recall that George W. Bush lost at the lower court level all the way up into the Supreme Court, too, until Bush v. Gore, where he won because the lower courts improperly adjudicated the constitutional issues.
Well, is this going to get to the U.S. Supreme Court?
Well, I think that's a question. I mean, there's still this sort of unknowns in Pennsylvania, which I wish people would focus more upon, which is how many ballots were received after Election Day? Were they segregated as per Justice Alito's order? How many ballots were cured in counties throughout Pennsylvania? How many ballots could have been cured but were not? In other words, so how many ballots were thrown out in counties where curing your ballot was not available because the local election official didn't pursue the opportunity, I guess, that the Secretary of State of Pennsylvania had provided the counties. At least that's the argument that's made. That's what happened. And because I still say the cert petition will turn in part on a pragmatic read as to whether even ruling in the president's favor, even moving to implement a remedy that is sought, does that have the potential to change the outcome of the election? If it doesn't, I think it's unlikely the court takes up the case, and then it really is over. But right now, just understand the Michigan certification, that does bring a sense of finality, mm-hmm. just the certification votes, but it's not over. The nothing is set in stone until December 8th, and that when the electors are organized by their states, and then December 14th is the date of the actual Electoral College vote transmitted to Congress. Okay. So that's where we're at.
And President Trump, who stayed pretty quiet yesterday, about 10 hours ago, tweeted, you know, that he commends Emily Murphy at GSA for her steadfast dedication and loyalty to our country. Our case strongly, all in capitals, continues, and we will keep up the good fight, and I believe we will prevail.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, it's in the best interest to begin the transition process.
The whole transition story is completely overblown.
Well, it's a soap opera. Come on.
It's just completely overblown. It's a non-event. Oh, the GSA needs to do this, and it needs to make funds available so John Kerry can get to work on saving the planet. I mean, it's just such a non-story. This is the sort of thing that the D.C. press corps hyperventilates about, that it amounts
to
nothing. Amounts to absolutely nothing.
312-642-5600. Turnkey.pro answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
And by the way, Giuliani is well aware of those December 8th and December 14th dates, and he does understand the urgency.
Oh, the deadlines are urgent, no question about it. There isn't a lot of time, but there's time. And the fact is that the facts are there. We just need to get them before a trier of fact or before a court that'll be fair, and we'll listen to them. I mean, the court in Pennsylvania cut it off without listening to a single fact. And I don't know how the judge could have concluded that the facts aren't substantial when they haven't even been presented yet. They're really kind of... And on a motion to dismiss, well, you're not supposed to consider that. So unfortunately, we haven't yet gotten a fair decision. We will. We got to be a little patient. One fair decision, one good hearing, and this will turn all around.
Well, we'll see. He's going to have that one, that opportunity for one good hearing before the Third Circuit Court of Appeals, as I mentioned. But on the district court case, you know, for a motion to dismiss, you take the argument in the light most favorable to the moving party, and could they succeed under the law? And the judge in the district court said no. And basically, I agree with him. Upon reading the opinion and the argument that was made by the Trump legal team, in part because, as I said from the outset, their remedy was just the remedy was not a tenable remedy without getting into all of the details. The idea of essentially discounting millions of votes because of a theory about some of the votes. That is not what a judge is going to do, and including at the Supreme Court level. Jen Ellis, as I mentioned, MSNBC, she was asked over and over again by Ari Melber, who did a good job of doing exactly what I said the press corps was doing, conflating a bunch of issues, cherry picking, recount versus other other avenues to prosecute in terms of voter fraud allegations. And his whole point was, you know, hey, what's the point of this? You can't win. You're not trying to win. So what's the point of this? And she responded.
And say, well, if you're not going to change the vote to the recount, what is the point? That's the real question I don't think has been answered.
Because we've never had in the history of America as many mail-in ballots as we have in this election. Absolutely, recounts can change this election. Our lawsuits are all about election integrity, and we're making sure that we put this together as one big lawsuit to make sure that election integrity is preserved in each of these states. If you look at what happened on the ground in each of these states, there is massive election official fraud by going against the will of the state legislatures to change the election results in those states, and altogether, of course, this is outcome determinative, and every single American should want us to be able to present that evidence in court, which consists of thousands of pages of witnesses that are voters, that are election officials, and that
Ed in Oak Brook, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, I mean, it's nothing but gloom and doom the last few weeks, but, you know, yesterday you guys were talking about evidence, and I don't have all what Giuliani sees. I don't even probably have all that you guys see. But what I do see is a media 100% against Trump, even Fox. I see the law enforcement, premier law enforcement agency of this country plotted against Trump. I've seen one candidate campaign with millions of people following him. Okay. Then I see the other candidate didn't even campaign at all, but yet he gets 80 million votes. I've seen the engineer, this is all on YouTube, by the way, I've seen the engineer of the firm that designed the software, this Dominion software, his rants and even his verbal rants against Trump, how he hates him and used profanity and so forth, and guaranteeing that Trump would never win. This is all on YouTube, by the way. I've seen, or some guys that lived in Detroit were talking about the election in Detroit and how 137,000 votes, no name, no address, no nothing, were counted as votes. From the same city that day in voting, or when you can vote in person, there's only like 15%. Okay, this is Detroit. We've seen enough movies about Detroit to know who lives in Detroit. I've seen experts on YouTube describe how those machines can be manipulated, and they're fraught with fraud, that you can change them and so forth. I've seen top Republicans waffle. I don't know if that's proof or evidence, but that just shows you how weak they are. And I've seen Democrats in the past lie and cheat about everything. The Russian thing, I mean, you keep bringing that up, all that kind of stuff. And this has been going on for years, and it's all protected by a media. So this is the stuff that I see. Okay, I don't know. I see all of the stuff that these guys are going through, Giuliani and this lady and even, well, Miss Sydney. They're probably overwhelmed with crap, and they're under the gun. And, you know, this case probably should take about 3 years, but they don't have that much time. Anyway,
thanks for the call, Ed. Message received.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. We'll get to COVID in just a second, but I did want to also include something that Rachel Maddow had to say on MSNBC yesterday. She was speaking with the legal defense counsel for the NAACP, Sharon Eiffel. And, you know, she's ready to move on, and obviously the country should move with Rachel Maddow.
Exactly.
And but not before we address what the Trump campaign and the Trump campaign lawyers have done, which is to violate norms, according to post-election norms, according to Rachel Maddow. And so, you know, what should be done to ensure that these norms that Rachel Maddow invented for the purposes of this election are preserved for on a go-forward basis? She has an idea, and she wanted to run it by counsel.
We've got this thing that's ended in Michigan in terms of the certification. And I feel like we're sort of now waking up to new realities. One of the things that I'm concerned about is what the Trump administration is going to do during this lame duck period and in the transition to try to set the place on fire, proverbially, as they go. But I think a lot of people are also worried about what you were just describing there, about these tactics, both by the president and by his campaign and by Republicans who support him, that after an election, elections officials are now subject to lobbying, subject to pressure, subject to enticement or threats in a way that should get them to do whatever their party or the party in power or anybody else who has an effect in terms of influencing them can get them to do. I want to go back to that not being a norm in our democracy. I'm worried that now that the Trump administration has set this precedent, it will be. And it feels like the only way to stop that becoming the new normal, at least in Republican politics, is for some people to go to jail for it or to feel like they are going to get in trouble if they get caught doing something like that. Is that the right way to think about it?
And
Miss
Eiffel says, yes, it is, in fact, the right way to think about it, officer of the court.
What is she afraid that they're going to do?
We're going to put, Rudy Giuliani and Jenna Ellis in jail for what exactly? Who are we going to put in jail and under what charges?
Yeah.
So now we've gone from, on the left, from it is improper, it's violating norms, for the Trump campaign to pursue and for the president to pursue his legal rights. That's improper. We've decided Biden has won, and that's the end of it. So just accept that result and concede. You're not allowed to pursue your legal the legal avenues that you're entitled to pursue. Now it's if you do that, then you go to jail. But no, I mean, this is obviously an administration and a movement, the left, Jacobins, that are going to bring the country together. Oh, clearly. Yeah. Len in Fox Lake, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Morning, guys. You guys are going to make fun of me. Your show is very important, and shows like yours is very important across this country because, like I told you the last time I called, these radio shows have to be one of the ways that Trump was able to get the amount of votes that he got with all the media being against him. So just wanted to say that really quickly. Sidney Powell, what she's doing is very important for the country going forward. I think Trump has such an uphill battle with all these legal, you know, proceedings and stuff in all these states. I don't think he's going to be successful. However, Michael Flynn was just trying to figure out how much time he was going to do until Sidney Powell got involved. Now his case more than likely is going to be thrown out. The voting integrity in our country is all we have is that in order to keep our republic intact. So she has to, her battle is almost more important than Trump winning or losing. As weird as that is to say, she needs to be successful. If we do not have voting integrity in our country, we have nothing.
Thanks for the call, Len. Appreciate it.
Yeah, I mean, everybody wants secure elections in the future. There's no doubt. So I applaud what they're doing, but is there any there? And if so, step up to the plate and let's go.
Bill on the Northwest side.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. I believe that Trump only has two paths that are possible to overcome the election. Number one is whatever Cindy Powell has, and we don't know what she has, so I'm not going to speculate about that. But the other path is to uncover and prove massive mail-in voter fraud. And that got me to thinking, when Cook County does voting canvassing, they mail you a card, and on that card is your voter registration card. You have to cut it out with the scissors. And all the cards that get returned as addressee unknown get returned to the Board of Elections, which is run by Democrats. And that's a treasure trove. That's what Peter Strzok and Lisa Page would call an insurance policy, because whoever gains possession of those returned cards has the potential to commit or to initiate voting ballots. I mean, there was that one story on the Internet recently about how Richard M. Daley stole the election for JFK, and they went and canvassed a single-room occupancy hotel in Chicago from which 41 votes were cast, and the proprietor of the hotel said that 34 of those people hadn't lived there for years, and they voted. So, and that got me to thinking about Wisconsin. Sidney Powell said that tens of thousands of votes contained a perfect circle. when they filled out their vote for, you know, the president, as if a rubber stamp was used, as if there was, like, mass production of ballots. And that got me to thinking, Wisconsin is a state where the mailing envelopes supposedly got destroyed by accident. I don't think there ever were mailing envelopes. I don't think they were ever created. And so, you know, there's your potential for voting fraud right there. But the issue is, when does circumstantial evidence overcome something being a theory? Thank you for taking my call.
Thanks for the call, Bill. I mean, those are possible areas, right? Those are possible vulnerabilities if people have bad intentions. When does circumstantial evidence overcome the theory? Or it's not overcome, I guess. When does circumstantial evidence, when is it sufficient to get a ruling in your favor? Well, when it meets the burden of proof. When it meets the burden of proof, circumstantial evidence. And so I don't think there's any magic number of affidavits or other forms of evidence that could be presented. But this is what I think happened. There has to be some evidence, if nothing else, that prompts a further look at it. And I just don't think we're there. I mean, those things that Sidney Powell said, the perfect circle, 100,000 ballots, so on and so forth. Well,
it sounds good, but we need to see it or take it to a court of law, bring the evidence before a judge.
Yeah, and part of this is, I mean, to me, this is like, there's all these grand theories about perfectly synchronized conspiracies. To me, the more interesting possibilities and the more likely possibilities are things like in Wisconsin, for example, the indefinitely confined designation that was extended beyond all definition to include essentially everyone under a COVID lockdown or locking themselves down because of COVID and avoiding the voter ID requirement in Wisconsin by getting that indefinite confinement designation. That to me is a ripe area. If the data is true out of Georgia that there were 95,000 round numbers, 95,000 ballots in which only the presidential race was voted, and 94.5 of those were Biden, that seems to me a ripe area to look at signature, to do signature checks on absentee or mail-in ballot applications to check to see if they match, to verify. You know, it seems to trying to come up with these global explanations rather than focus on something that you can actually vet, that you can actually audit, that you can actually verify and challenge on the merits. I want to see these 95,000 ballots. Let's go through them. I want to see the couple hundred thousand people that voted and avoided the voter ID requirement in Wisconsin because they were indefinitely confined. I want to know how many ballots were received after the election in Pennsylvania. I want to know how many ballots were cured. I want to know how many ballots were thrown out that could have been cured because they came from counties where curing wasn't an option. I think if we could put our feet back on the ground, the Trump legal team could get their 2 feet back on the ground and focus on equal protection issues and cohorts of ballots that you could actually review and get some indication on whether or not there was something systemic going on. Because it seems to me if you had something systemic going on with respect to, say, those presidential race only ballots in Georgia. Now you go to court and say, hey, look, we went through this and look at the rate of failure to verify the signature, or look at the rate of the percentage of ballots where the signatures don't match. So we know something's going on. Now you start to get people's attention. Now that's evidence perhaps of something bigger going on in addition to whatever the court would do to address those ballots in, for example, knock them out, discount them, which may be material in an election decided by 12,000 votes, since we're talking about Georgia. Come back to this planet, put your both feet on the ground, focus on constitutional issues and specific cohorts of these tens of millions of ballots around the country that are under review that you can get your arms around. Janice in Morocco, Indiana.
Hi, Dan and Amy. I received a constituent survey in the mail a couple of days ago from our state senator, Rick Niemeyer, in Indiana. And one of the questions was, do you feel more confident that your vote will be counted if you A, vote in person, or B, vote by mail. So maybe there are some people out there in the government who are aware of our concerns of voter fraud.
All right. Thanks for the call, Janice. Joe on 294.
Yes, hi. Yeah, I was going to refer back to Rachel Maddow's guest saying, you know, they should put him in jail. I think they should start with the Secretary of State from PA, Pennsylvania, that didn't listen to what the Supreme Court said about putting the mail-in ballots and segregating them. Here they opening them up, and, you know, they shouldn't stop with her. They should go on to the Postmaster General that allowed the postal workers backdate the ballots. And then also, didn't Omar have her crew picking up ballots and harvesting them in Minnesota?
Thanks for the call, Joe.
That wasn't personally her.
No, well, it was, well, I mean, this is the Project Veritas investigation that supposedly the Minneapolis police picked up after James O'Keefe posted his investigation and talked to whistleblowers and said it was Omar's crew and said it was people paying for ballots. And you got guys on camera bragging about doing exactly that. That Minneapolis police tweeting out a couple days after that investigation, we're looking into it. Of course, another one of those investigations that's opened and, you know, quietly closed or quietly left open in perpetuity, and nothing ever comes of it. You never get a response.
What police officers do they have left? So many retired, and they defunded Minneapolis police,
You never get a response, and you never get any sort of conclusion. It's just, we open an investigation and hope people forget about it and don't pay attention. I mean, this is that Minneapolis example is a good reason why people have lost faith in the system in general, both when we're talking about the integrity of our elections as well as just the rule of law more generally. All right, when we come back, we will turn our attention to Turkey Day and all the turkeys in public office. Dan and Amy on Chicago's Morning Answer.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, and if you are traveling to Canada for the holidays, maybe you're going to see Jordan Peterson. I don't know. I just wanted to give people the heads up on this. There's an important message that officials in Jasper, which is an alpine town in Canada's Alberta province, have put up. Please do not allow the moose in Canada to lick your car.
Okay, it's not a salt lick. Why?
Do not let
Why do
moose
they lick your car
lick
anyway?
Your car. Actually, it is a salt lick. They're obsessed with salt. It's one of the things they need for minerals in their body. They usually get it from salt and lakes in the park, but now they realize they can get the road salt that splashes onto cars. And so the moose are licking the cars. And the problem with that, of course, that then they get used to
Licking the cars?
Coming up to the cars and licking the cars. And, you know.
So you can roll through the stop sign there?
Well, you probably don't want to hit a moose with your car. You don't want moose and cars mixing.
Have you ever seen a moose live? I mean, not at a zoo, but a real moose out in the wild?
I don't know.
I was in Norberg, Sweden. Took my breath away.
They have
such a majestic creature, so beautiful.
They have moose in Sweden?
Yeah, in northern Sweden, yeah.
Fascinating.
I went running and I ran one into one, and I'm like, "Oh, thank you for not killing me, Mr. Moose." And then I kept going.
Did you let the moose lick you in Sweden?
I didn't.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy, and Andrew Cuomo. He plays a governor on TV. You may know he's an Emmy award-winning actor.
You mentioned that yesterday at the end of the show. I didn't know it was an international Emmy award, Dan.
That's a big deal. Oh yeah. He was asked about that at his press conference yesterday, and this is what he had to say about being an Emmy award winner.
When I first heard,
oh my,
I was flattered by it.
Sure.
But then I looked into it a little bit.
And?
I
was really flat.
Oprah Winfrey won it. Steven Spielberg won it. Al Gore won it for Inconvenient Truth, which I thought was just masterful.
Of course, yeah.
It is flattering, but it's also symbolic. Just watched it before we came down. For it to be personalized to me, I want to make sure people understand that I'm just the symbol of a much larger effort.
It's nice to thank the little people.
The people who are around this table, who Rob, Melissa, Gareth.
Oh, thanks, guys.
Who were there every day.
Melissa, you're great.
Every public employee who was out there putting the numbers together every day.
Raises
and really, the
so
people
gracious.
Of the state.
Prepared remarks for this
who
Emmy Award.
Made it work, right? What they were saying on the presentation was, I gave facts. They never mentioned my sense of humor, by the way.
Oh, my God.
Nor did they mention any charisma or good looks.
Oh, you.
They didn't mention a lot of things. But they said I gave facts. But it's that New Yorkers responded. And New Yorkers did respond. And that's how you go from a 50% infection rate to a 1% infection rate.
And then he said, yeah, yeah.
What was he wearing when he gave the speech?
Armani.
Yeah.
And then he said, you like me, you really, really like me. And shuffled off the stage. It was a wonderful gala affair, his press conferences. They always are. That's Andrew Cuomo, Emmy Award winning, Emmy Award winning actor
right,
who
yeah.
plays a governor on TV. He also had some other things to say about upstate sheriffs in New York who will not enforce his not enforce his limitation on 10 people in a particular household mandate, the Thanksgiving mandates as they've come to be known, the holiday mandates. What does he think about them?
You have sheriffs upstate who have said, I'm not going to enforce the law. Now, how a law enforcement officer says, I choose not to enforce that law. I believe that law enforcement officer violates his or her constitutional duty. I don't consider them a law enforcement officer because you don't have the right to pick laws that you think you will enforce and you don't enforce laws that you don't agree with, right? That's not a law enforcement officer. That's a dictator.
You might be the dictator there, buddy.
Cops are the dictators. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Dictators, police, they're being political. He's not being political.
Okay. They are.
They're being political. It's so funny that you think he's being political. I'm not being political. They're being political.
I said to one person, I had a conversation with somebody on Staten Island, who said I'm not. Because the upstate sheriffs, what they're doing is they're being political. No more than 10 rule people find intrusive. You're telling me in my house I can't have more than 10 people? It's none of your business what I do in my home. Now, of course, it is. Laws apply in your home. Domestic violence applies in your home. Drug laws apply in your home. Yes, it does. Well, I'm going to celebrate Thanksgiving the way I always celebrate Thanksgiving, right? People on Staten Island. We're having the same big family Thanksgiving that we always have. And nobody's going to tell me not to have a big family Thanksgiving. I'm telling you that you are responsible for your actions.
Thanks, Dad.
And here are the numbers. And the numbers don't lie. And this is the increase before any other increase from Thanksgiving.
What do you think? like domestic violence, like drug laws, that Andrew Cuomo and other politicians have the right to come into your home and tell you how you're going to live when it's other regarding, because, you know, other people's interests are at stake. This is the argument he makes. And so it's perfectly legitimate for him to tell you how many people from how many households that you can have in your home. It's perfectly legitimate for Governor Inslee in Washington State or Governor Brown in Oregon to say how many people may be in a sleeping room. Perfectly okay for Governor Pritzker or Lori Lightfoot to come and read you a bedtime story to make sure that you've turned in on time, because this is other regarding. Other people's interests are at stake, and they can come into your home and tell you how it's going
to
be.
Well, in Oregon, Dan, you could face a fine of up to $1,250, or, are you ready for this, 30 days in jail, because Governor Kate Brown from Oregon yesterday, again, asking people to call police for people that are breaking COVID-19 rules. If somebody's having a big Thanksgiving party down the street, it is imperative that you call police.
What's the problem? You heard Andrew Cuomo. Drug laws, domestic violence, COVID regulations. It's all the same kind, is it? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line. 646-36DA, turnkey.pro, text line. Now, Cuomo did provide an out for those who don't want to comply. You don't want to comply? That's fine. You are just banished from all public services.
I said to one person, I had a conversation with somebody on Staten Island, who said, I'm not following these rules, they're all baloney. I said, I'll make you a deal. I will exempt you from all the rules. You agree, if you or anyone in your family gets sick, you're purely responsible. He said, what do you mean? I said, if you get sick, or your family gets sick, you're responsible. You stay at home and get better. If you have to go into the hospital, you pay the bill. You find a nurse to take care of you. You find an ambulance driver who wants to drive a COVID-positive person to the hospital. You're responsible. Well, no, no, no. I'm not doing that. I said, oh, see.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line. Because in Cook County, here's the theme yesterday, Dan.
A virtual safe Thanksgiving will potentially prevent an ICU Christmas. Please make no mistake that people will die because of Thanksgiving gatherings.
That's a great line. Yeah. They should put that on a brochure.
It's going to be a hashtag soon.
Did you fully internalize what Andrew Cuomo just said? Here's the deal for the guy in Staten Island. I mean, there's so many layers to that. You figure out how to take care of yourself. You find an ambulance driver who will take a COVID-infected patient, like you're possessed by a demon. Find a nurse who will take care of a COVID-infected patient.
You get your own demosphere.
I'm sorry. Don't we have COVID-infected patients in hospitals? Haven't we from the beginning?
Yeah, we have.
So what is this? What is this idea that you can't find anybody to transport somebody who needs to be transported to a hospital because they've got a serious, their condition with respect to COVID is serious, or be treated in a hospital because their condition is serious? That's where you administer these prescription drugs. This is where you are put on a ventilator, perhaps as needed. What are you talking about? Oh, by the way, I also pay taxes for these services. Oh, by the way, the idea that I should have to pay for my hospital stay. Wow, what a novel concept. Once upon a time in America, Andrew Cuomo, we didn't have a backdoor government takeover of healthcare, and people actually did pay for the healthcare services they accessed. But I appreciate your willingness to return to that universe. I'll tell you what, the scenario Andrew Cuomo played out, you'll exempt me from all the rules. If I accept those responsibilities you outlined, I'll raise my hand. Where should I sign?
I think that International Emmy Award went to his head, because he was an exact dictator yesterday with those comments that he made about what we do in our household, and if we do, the ramifications are find your own nurse, find your own ambulance to take you to the hospital. Go pound sand. There's a 1968 rule that if anybody shows up in an emergency room, they have to be treated.
Well, it's absurd, and he thinks he's demonstrating the absurdity of the Staten Island guy's position by saying, here's the deal for you. In fact, he's demonstrating his own rolling absurdity. This guy is an idiot. Andrew Cuomo is a clown, and his dramatic, staccato way of explaining himself and answering questions doesn't give him any more gravitas. Absolute clown. Sheriffs are dictators, and those who disagree with or will not follow Andrew Cuomo's edicts are to be banished from the public sphere.
And not even helped if they need health care.
The whole thing is so overwrought. It is ridiculous. Here's an example of a sheriff, the kind of sheriff he's talking about. Now, this is across the bay in New Jersey. This is Chief Andrew Kudick, Howell Township, New Jersey. Here's what he said about these gathering restrictions, the numbers, and having sheriffs in force.
I'm out there in the community driving around, and I see how much they're hurting. So as a police chief in charge of 100-plus police officers, I felt it was just incumbent upon me just to let them know and my community know that we're not going to basically enforce some of these executive orders, which I feel are basically draconian. We all know we're not going to be used to go door to door on something like that, whereas we're checking to see how many people are gathered for Thanksgiving, especially when political activities are exempt from the executive order.
I feel like we're living in a communist country or a really bad nightmare where they want our lawmakers want the sheriff's department to go door to door and check to see what we're doing. Lori Lightfoot has 2,000 employees who could be doing that this Thanksgiving. She had threatened it. We don't know if she's going to go through with it.
I appreciate that some of these sheriffs have more respect for the consent of the governed than the politicians. That's a fact. It's the Andrew Cuomo stuff is just stunning to me. Oh. By the way, the comparison, we can come into your home because it's just like domestic violence. Right. It's just like drug use. It's another regarding action.
It's just although, Thanksgiving, freedom to assemble.
Yeah, those are not in the same category, actually. Mike in Knoxville, Tennessee.
Hey there. I think the police of the upstate, aren't they just establishing sanctuary cities?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yes, right. Very good. Thanks for the call, Mike. Yeah, right. Andrew Cuomo is so offended by who gets to decide what laws they're going to enforce or not, speaking of somebody in a sanctuary state, sanctuary city. Yeah, perfect.
You can't make this stuff up.
Nick in Northwest Indiana.
Yeah, hey, how you doing? As a police officer, I find it kind of irresponsible, his comments, when there's a thing called discretion. If somebody's going 10 miles over the speed limit, I could use a little discretion and give them a break. But the other thing that I think Ms. Jacobson just alluded to was freedom of assembly. There's assembly of illegality and there's assembly of legality. We're not assembling as a family to put bricks of cocaine together. We're assembling
not this Thanksgiving,
to eat turkeys.
Maybe Christmas.
Okay. Yeah, come on.
Stocking
now.
Stuffers, come on.
There you go. Thanks.
I love
Thanks,
Northwest
Nick.
Indiana.
Mark in Libertyville.
Hey, morning, guys. Hey, I just find it ironic that in some cases the left is very passionate about, which is, my body, my choice when it comes to their reproductive rights. But in an instance where they appear to be passionate or very passionate about the science, which means wear a mask and social distance. But in this regard, my body, my choice doesn't apply. So I just find it very ironic that in some cases that they want to push the issue, my body, my choice, will stay away. But in this case, my body, my choice. No, it's not your body, your choice. It's my choice. The whole thing I just find infuriating.
Thanks for the call, Mark. Jim in Palatine.
Hey, good morning, guys. These are the same asshat governors and attorneys general that are watching their cities be burned and looted and want to defund the police instead of, you know, murder rates going up. Why don't they worry about that instead of who's going to whose house for Thanksgiving?
Thanks, Jim. John in Lincolnwood.
Hi, Dan and Amy. I overheard this Cuomo getting an Emmy for probably nothing. But anyway.
Yeah.
International Emmy. Big difference.
Whatever.
That's a big
deal.
Does
it matter?
Yeah.
The point I'm trying to make is he said that, you know, is the drugs in your house, the drug laws and all this. Those are laws, are they not? Those are laws. COVID, did they pass some law?
Well, they'd have to assemble the state legislature and pass a law. I thought it was a mandate.
These are emergency orders by the governor. That's right.
Mm-hmm. But it's not a law.
Well, he would argue they have the force of law, and you know, thus the discussion of enforcement. But I mean, sorry to cut you off, John. But the larger point you're getting to is the important one, which is the point I made yesterday about the difference between the state's ability to enforce and the state's authority to enforce. All the discussion is about ability rather than taking that step back and saying, wait a second, is this a legitimate expression of state authority? Tony and Steger.
You know, I'll take that ticket. I mean, I don't have to pay taxes anymore. I won't have to get a permit for what I want to do on my property. I can find a doctor that'll want to make some cash.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Thanks, Tony. Mary in Knoxville, Tennessee. A lot of Knoxville, Tennessee.
Hi. Yes, we are. And I moved out of Chicago 2 years ago, and I praise God every day I'm here. Mm. I'm calling just with two short comments. He made a comment that numbers don't lie. Oh, yeah, that's right. But statisticians sure do. It's an old saying going way back. Mm-hmm. And then the other comment that these people who will go against his ruling about the number of people that they can have, then they won't get any kind of health care or whatever. Yes. Well, prisoners get health care. They even get transgender surgery. So that's all I wanted to say. Have a wonderful day, and God bless us and keep us strong.
Thanks, Mary.
Amen. All right. Thanks, Mary. Dan and Amy coming to you from Chicago's Morning Answer.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Your show keeps me alive during the week. There's nobody I'd rather listen to between 5 and 9 in the morning than you guys.
On AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. The question with respect to the vaccines coming online, soon to be, the head of Operation Warp Speed saying recently he expects the first Americans to be inoculated with an approved vaccine by December 11th or 12th, just a couple of weeks away.
Great
Pfizer,
news.
Moderna, Oxford, AstraZeneca. The question is, what's the basis for distribution of the vaccine in the initial rounds, where obviously you will have fewer doses than you need, and also just the rank prioritization of the distribution for what you do have in stock. Should it be based in equity or efficacy? The equity argument is being made by a lot of identitarian politicians, including our very own Governor Jellyby.
Yeah, because remember we had Dr. Sally Satel on yesterday, and she suggested that we should, you know, after you take care of the nurses and the doctors and the, you know, first responders, possibly teachers after that, but also focus on zip codes where people, you know, there's generations of people living together. And I asked Governor Pritzker that yesterday.
Well, Amy, I'll turn this over to Dr. Zike in a moment, but I just want to say that one of the big concerns that I have is making sure that we do this with an equity lens. And that includes not only people of color, but, you know, rural communities, places that often are left out and left behind, forgotten. I want them to be significantly considered for the near-term possibility of getting the vaccine. But this vaccine is going to roll out over quite a number of months. We're not really going to see, as I understand, the vaccine coming to the general public until perhaps March or April at the earliest.
So they have no set plan yet, but what he said at the end, March or April at the earliest. So we're going to live like this until next March and April at the earliest.
Well,
that's how I translated that.
Perhaps. I mean, the distribution is the question, and it's a decision that's not going to be made by Governor Pritzker, at least not until Illinois is the focus of receipt of the vaccine. answer the question again, equity or efficacy? We're going to let identitarian politics drive the distribution, or is it about saving as many lives and using the vaccines in their highest, best form? The efficacy argument made by Tyler Cohen over at Bloomberg, Tyler Cohen, George Mason University economics professor, said vaccine distribution should not be fair. A central yet neglected point is that vaccines should not be sent to every part of the U.S. Instead, it would be better to concentrate distribution in a small number of places where the vaccines can have greater impact. Say, for the purpose of argument, you had 20,000 vaccine doses to distribute. There are about 20,000 cities and towns in America. Would you send one dose to each location? That might sound fair, but such a distribution would limit the overall effect. Many of those 20,000 recipients would be safer, but your plan would not meaningfully reduce community transmission in any of those places, nor would it allow public events to restart or schools to open. That's starting from the premise that schools shouldn't be open regardless, but just play it out. Or you can choose one town or well-defined area and distribute all 20,000 doses there. Then you protect 20,000 people with the vaccine. The surrounding area becomes much safer. Children could go to school knowing most of the other people in the building had been vaccinated. Shopping and dining would boom as well. And then you radiate out from there. So, for example, he uses, if you started Wilmington, Delaware, then you radiate out from Wilmington, Delaware, sort of the oil spot technique. Go from a position of strength to outlying positions of weakness as you expand. So which should it be? It seems like, and this is essentially after the prioritization of frontline healthcare workers and perhaps even people who are vulnerable. Although the vulnerable population, that really gets into definition too, because I mean, if vulnerable means you just have a comorbidity, I mean, that's going to overwhelm the amount of vaccine doses available as well. If it means somebody over 70 with a vulnerability or with a comorbidity, that's something different. For more on all of this, these complicated questions. Mm-hmm. We're pleased to be joined by Dr. Darcy Bryan, healthcare policy expert at the Mercatus Center. Dr. Bryan, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure. I'm glad to be speaking with you.
So what about this discussion that we're having and that needs to be had, equity versus efficacy in distribution?
I think it's absolutely a very important question. I think it's something that I've thought quite a bit about. But ironically enough, the very practicality of the kind of vaccine that we've had produced by Pfizer and Moderna that's passed the phase three studies and is now going to the FDA for licensing and approval, I think is going to answer that question in its own way, just based on how the vaccine is needing to be distributed in super cold freezers and stored, because the minute the temperature thaws, and the vaccine loses its efficacy or its ability to help people. And so automatically you've got urban centers favored, because large hospitals, academic centers are going to have the equipment to store the vaccine and are very vulnerable in rural areas. They're going to really struggle with how to get that to their patient population. So I think because Operation Warp Speed focused and poured a lot of money into safety and efficacy, which is great, but less focus was on the practicality of distribution in terms of how the vaccine gets stored. So the vaccine that we have is very effective, but it's also very fragile.
But what about the AstraZeneca vaccine? I heard that doesn't need to be stored in minus 72 degree
right.
temperatures, that it could just
right.
be in your refrigerator. So that's good news, isn't it?
That is good news, absolutely. The efficacy is going to be a little bit less. It's according to the data I saw, it was 70% versus 95%, but that is definitely good news. But we're talking about the immediate rollout and the timing of when the general population, the average person, is going to be able to get the vaccine. And I'm just saying that the actual nature of the vaccine that we have first out the gate is going to be the difficulty in terms of distribution.
Sure. Okay, but setting that aside, you know, uh-huh. you're still going to have, if you're hearing politicians right now, of course, they're this is all being forced through a political lens like every other aspect of COVID, saying, you have a higher incidence of COVID and COVID-related deaths among the Black American population, among the Latino American population. And so we need to, you know, provide vaccines to those communities in some sort of proportional way. And then of course that prompts, okay, well, even if we were going to do that, we were going to set aside, say, 12, 20%, 25%, whatever the number is for the Black community. Okay, so where does that go? To Detroit, Atlanta, Chicago, New York? But the politicians aren't thinking this through, so intelligent people like you need to do so on their behalf.
Well, thank you. And I would say that the CDC has basically asked the bioethicists to really sit down and think this thing through. I like the National Academy of Science, what their recommendation was, which was four phases of distribution. The main focus was on fairness and transparency and equity. What I will say, and just as in a parentheses comment, is that there was an interesting article that came out that was basically saying, based on mathematical models, you know, if we targeted the super spreaders, the people who are most social among us, and vaccinated them, then we would have a really large impact on preventing transmission. So there's two ways of focusing in on vaccination. One is who's going to be transmitting it the most social among us. And the other one is on the most vulnerable. And traditionally in this country, we've focused in on the most vulnerable. So the National Academy of Science basically said, hey, phase one, high-risk healthcare workers, those with comorbid health conditions, you know, the ones who are super vulnerable with their underlying health, older adults and folks in nursing homes, they should be getting it first. And then basically it's a staged release based on, you know, phase two with teachers and critical workers, people who are critical for national security, those who are moderately in poor health, people living in shelters and prisons, things like that. And then phase three, young adults and children, and phase four, everyone else.
Well, Dr. Brian, we have a lot of people with comorbidities in this country.
Yes.
And we have a lot of elderly, too. Should they use a lottery system, or do you think it would ever come to that?
I hope not, because you know, we put in an awful lot of money in ramping up production. And really the way Operation Warp Speed is working is all the safety mechanisms have been held in place, but the government has assumed risk for these companies that are producing the vaccine, saying, hey, we're gonna cover your costs with production. So production is already underway. And I'm hoping that is going to make it less of a scarcity issue.
But what about, you know, again, below the fold here, these categories, there's studies out that suggest maybe a quarter of the population has a natural immunity to COVID-19 without ever having been infected. There are the number of people who have had asymptomatic infections, in addition to those people who were sick and recovered. And I wonder if we have sort of a heat map of concentrations of those people. So we know, for example, if it seems to be the case that this virus has ripped through New York already pretty well in the spring as compared to some other major metropolitan areas, for example, then should we prioritize those areas that have a smaller percentage of the infected and the recovered, the asymptomatically infected? I mean, I guess unless you test, you really don't have any way of knowing who's got an innate immunity. But I mean, some of the data that we do have, should that be mapped so that we're, again, sending the initial batch of vaccine doses for their highest, best use?
Yeah, and that sounds really rational. And unfortunately, from what I've seen from what the CDC has commented on, is we don't seem to think that natural immunity holds for very long with COVID, based on early evidence. And we don't really have a good way of measuring immunity still, and that's going to be a problem also with vaccinating. We simply don't know how long the vaccine will be effective for. There's a lot of unknowns there.
Well, with respect to the asymptomatic, this is really interesting because back in June, Dr. Maria Van Kerkhove, the head of WHO's Emerging Diseases Unit, almost ended her career by suggesting that per the known research, asymptomatic spread was very rare. From the data we have, it seems to be rare that an asymptomatic person actually transmits onward to a secondary individual. It's very rare, she said. And then, you know, she had to decide whether she was going to keep her position, so she recanted in part. Well, there's a study out that, of course, has got no attention, just like mass studies that don't comport with conventional wisdom to get no attention, that looked at 10 million residents of Wuhan, China. There were no positive tests among 1,174 close contacts of asymptomatic cases. This was not rare. This study in Wuhan, China, finds no zero cases of asymptomatic transmission. And so if we know, some estimates, 20%? I mean, I've seen that much higher, but let's be conservative. 20% of the cases are asymptomatic in the infections. So if we know who was infected and had an asymptomatic response, and we know what we know about transmission, can't we discount those areas because you have people who are, number one, you have that percentage of infected, but number two, you have people that are not likely to transmit?
Yeah, and I don't know how we could practically do that given the kind of the general mindset of vaccination, which is to distribute as quickly and widely as possible. And yes, these phases are in place, but I think the thinking is it's not going to be a matter of years, it's going to be a matter of months. So in terms of practicality and actually making those determinations and having the apparatus to make those determinations, I think that would be very difficult.
So instead, it's just going to be sort of a blunt approach by saying, here's categories of people, and we'll distribute to healthcare workers around the country. We'll distribute to teachers around the country. We'll distribute to childcare workers around the country because it's easy.
Well, easier. I don't know if it's going to be easy.
Easier than being surgical.
Right. I think we all appreciate the bureaucratic process, and it's not surgical.
Yeah. All right. She is Dr. Darcy Bryan. She's a healthcare policy expert at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Dr. Bryan, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. The head of New York Police Department's largest union issuing a stark warning to subway riders amid a rash of shoving incidents and so forth. The message to subway owners, or subway riders, I should say, in New York. You're on your own. Police Benevolent Association President Pat Lynch said, the politicians have made it abundantly clear that they don't want cops enforcing transit system rules, connecting the homeless with services, engaging with seriously mentally ill, or doing any of the things necessary to prevent these terrifying random attacks. That is their choice to make, but who is replacing us in these roles? Right now, nobody. While our elected leaders are closing their eyes and wishing the problem away, we recommend that all New Yorkers keep both eyes wide open while in our transit system. That is, it's nice to hear from the police department. You're on your own.
But they're paying taxes, huh?
But that's what a lot of, but that's what a lot of families in big cities feel like. And that, I think in part, this will have to be the product of some more postmortem, but just intuition. You know, how do you explain the difference between President Trump potentially losing the presidential election while House Republicans pick up 9, 10, 12 seats? Odd. You thought the two would be inextricably tied together. They're not. And it was pickups in suburban areas of big cities, including in New York State, including in California. It's very interesting. One can't help but wonder if the defund police movement and the radicalization of the left, particularly maybe on the air in the area of public safety, was one of the reasons people just decided that they needed to turn out some of their members of Congress who were either in bed with or appeasing people suggesting that the police should go away and we'll figure it out after we defund the police. And that includes minorities as well. Again, President Trump, 60-year high with the percentage of the black vote for a Republican presidential candidate, and moved the needle up a couple of ticks with respect to Latino voters as well. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Kay Himowitz from Manhattan Institute and City Journal. Kay, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Good morning.
Good morning. So you wrote specifically about Latino voters and it wasn't as pronounced as some would hope, the increase, but it was an increase nonetheless, which is, you know, continues to be rather remarkable for somebody who the sort of assembled Western institutions called a racist for the better part of 4+ years, that he increased his percentage of both the black vote and the Latino vote. And it turns out you're suggesting that there's a growing percentage of Latinos in America who are more interested in sort of meat and potatoes, economic security concern issues than they are identity politics.
Yeah, that's right. What I found in looking back is that Latinos, Hispanics, I use the word, have always been a little uneasy, if not hostile, to the identity politics. That showed up, I think, in this election. I mean, remember that when Julian Castro was running for president in 2016, he must have been banking on a large Hispanic following, and he never got more than 7% of the primary vote. In other words, Latinos were not looking for a Latino candidate; they were looking for somebody who spoke to them on other levels. So. There are many examples through the years, in recent years in particular, of Latinos who really don't think that way. And this election highlighted that they're a very diverse group, they tend to identify more with their home country. Cubans are going to think differently than Mexicans about many issues, as we saw. And in South Texas, you have a large number of Hispanics who have been there for many, many years. It's almost 90% Latino in many of the counties there. They don't think about racism very much, as one ex-mayor said of the area, because they're all brown, and they think of themselves as a part of a community that's basically American.
Well, that's an important point too, is yeah. Because the way we talk about these things is sort of these monolithic categories: Latinos, Blacks, Asians. But it's not only different ethnicities under the umbrella Latino, but it's also different generations. Your second and third generation, you may have some different attitudes about America than your first generation.
That's right. Although I also, and some of those older Latinos are sold on the American dream. They have a better life here, many of them. So they kind of buy into the story that a lot of progressives are rejecting as a fantasy. So I think that's part of it, too. For younger Latinos, I think the picture is a little more mixed. You have kids who are moving up and going to college, and they are sounding a lot like the progressives on campus. But then you have a lot of them more working class who have a lot of optimism about what this country can get them and about their economic future. And that's an important thing to keep in mind when you're trying to talk to them.
Okay, can you explain what happened in Miami-Dade County between what Hillary accomplished and what Joe Biden accomplished in regards to the Hispanic vote?
Right. So Hillary took Miami-Dade. It's not mostly Cuban, but a lot Cuban. I don't have the exact numbers on me. And they had mostly been voting Democratic, and Hillary took it, I believe, by 30 points. But Biden and the Democrats, by the way, were depending on this margin to take Florida. But Biden saw his lead evaporate or vaporize into something closer to 5% or 6% advantage. So he won Miami-Dade, but by so little that it affected his chances in Florida, and indeed Democrats lost Florida.
Well, and Donna Shalala got kicked out, too, which was an unexpected upset.
Yeah.
Well, the other thing about Florida, too, which is interesting, it speaks to the Latino vote. Same thing in Arizona. And this goes back to the governor's races 2 years ago, DeSantis in Florida and Ducey in Arizona, school choice. And the constituency that's been built in those states through school choice programs that are promoted by Republicans and opposed by Democrats because they're beholden to the teachers' unions. And that's been the beginning of somewhat of a realignment in that community as well, it seems.
Oh, that's interesting. I hadn't seen that. In the South Texas border counties that have gotten so much attention, the issues tended to be more about the economy. They were very worried about the jobs that might be taken away by the move to a all-green economy because that's oil country down there. A lot of people are in the oil and energy business. And a lot of them work as border guards, by the way. And they're not so keen on the anti-ICE and anti-border guard sentiment that you hear on the left quite a bit.
I wonder if this something that Shelby Steele wrote recently in the Wall Street Journal applies to the Latino community as well. Shelby Steele writing about the inauthenticity behind Black Lives Matter. And he talks about, and this is obviously not perfect because the history of Black Americans is different than Latino Americans, but nonetheless, tell me what you think about what he had to say here. There's an elephant in the room. It's simply that we blacks aren't much victimized anymore. Today, we are free to build a life that won't be stunted by racial persecution. Today, we are far more likely to encounter racial preferences than racial discrimination. Moreover, we live in a society that generally shows us goodwill, a society that has isolated racism as its most unforgivable sin. Do you think, I know that is the prevailing opinion among the elites and those who still, I guess, think that their victimization is a positive for them as some sort of pathway to power. But it seems to me that more black men in particular are starting to come around to that perspective. And I wonder if that's the perspective that a lot of Latino men and women have as well, that it is so some of the, you know, you're a victim, you're being oppressed, just falls on deaf ears increasingly.
Yeah, I'm sure that's true. I think what's also striking is how much Latinos are like previous generations of immigrants. They chose to come here. I mean, so their story is very different than Black story. They chose to come here. They wanted to come here because they saw opportunity here. Many of them are finding it. The upward mobility rates of Latinos are about like whites, which is, you know, too low by many of our sites. I mean, but as high as it is for whites. So they're not treated, they don't necessarily see their future as any more diminished than anybody else's. And they wanted to be here. So I think that really changes the attitudes and the framework with which they're understanding this country.
She is Kay Hemowitz. She's at City Journal and the Manhattan Institute as well. Kay, thanks so much for joining us, as always. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, do you have a vegan in your life? Is there going to be a vegan at your Thanksgiving dinner on Thursday?
My ex-husband's a vegan now, and his new wife.
Does he still use identifiers, he and him? Oh, boy. Well, you may want to tell him this. Have a burger already. Relax and have a burger.
Eat your meat. Wanting to eat your meat.
A large longitudinal study published Sunday in the journal BMC Medicine, which I know you read.
Oh, yeah. Put that copy back on my desk, please. Yes.
There are 19.4 more cases of fractures in vegans and 4.1 more cases in vegetarians for every 1,000 people over the course of this 10-year study. The point is that vegans, 43% more likely to suffer bone fractures than people that who enjoy a nice burger. This is a big study. 55,000 healthy adults from the UK, meat eaters, pescatarians, vegetarians, vegans.
Pescatarian?
Yeah, fish only.
Oh, yeah, I knew that. From pescina, the Latin term. Yes, fish. Go on. Yes, sir.
The study found that the study found almost 4,000 total fractures among the participants, and they surveyed lifestyle and so forth. On average, vegans with lower calcium and protein intake saw 43% higher risk of fractures anywhere on their bodies, and specifically in the hips, legs, and vertebrae. Probably also because they were beaten for being so annoying. But I'm guessing there. I don't know that.
Well,
that's
they need
not
to get enough
study.
Calcium and protein, and they're not getting that if you're just eating plant-based, you know, if a plant-based diet. It's not going to happen.
Exactly.
He said.
Veal Milanese. Have something. Have a piece of meat. Have a nice piece of meat.
I don't think I could last a day being a vegan. Could you? Or a vegetarian?
No. I mean, I could last a day only because my body wouldn't shut down after one day, but my body would ultimately shut down because I would have nothing to eat.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Let freedom ring this afternoon at 2 with Sean Hannity on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Some contextual data to include in your reflection on COVID lockdown policies. This from a rapper across the pond in the UK about British fatalities. In the UK, the median age of death from COVID is 81 for men and 85 for women.
Wow.
The average life expectancy in the UK is 80 for men and 83 for women.
So congratulations, winner, winner, chicken dinner.
Well, the point is, I mean, the point is obvious. The median life, so let's do apples to apples. Median age of death from COVID, 81 for men and 85 for women in the UK. The median life expectancy in the UK is 79 for men and 83 for women. So the median age of death from COVID is above the median age the median life expectancy for both men and women in Britain. You understand this? And so what are the policies? How do you explain the policies that pretend that everybody has sort of equal exposure, vulnerability? It represents a equally lethal threat to everyone. We mentioned this yesterday. Fox Chicago reporting 100 deaths 3 days in a row. No context.
No. No
I'm,
age.
I'm sorry.
No one said had comorbidities. What were the age of the victims? They don't know.
Well, also in the number of people who die on a daily basis.
300.
Unfortunately, that's the reality.
Six people die a day in Illinois from COPD.
From our friends over at Wirepoint, Ted Dabrowski and John Klinger. November 17th, that is, Illinois officials reported 168 deaths due to COVID. 168, November 17th, a week ago. 93% of the victims were older than 60. The average age of all the fatalities that day was 80. Sadly, the number of those over the age of 80 totaled 94 of the 168. In contrast, 3 of the COVID victims were under the age of 50. But we're going to pretend being under the age of 50, being over the age of 80 is the same in terms of exposure, lethality, vulnerability. That's what we're doing. And this points up something else, too. All hands should be on deck And the press corps should be focused on what is it that you're not doing to quell the spread, to stop the spread, to slow the spread in long-term care facilities, where to date, over 9 months, more than half of all deaths in Illinois have occurred. More than half. And you're going to tell me we're worried about little Johnny and little Mary at the daycare center with their daycare center operator, or little Johnny and little Mary in first grade with their first grade teacher, who's also under the age of 50. This is insanity. The political ruling class in this state, like in so many other states, men and women of science and data whose lockdown policies run counter to the science and data. I don't know how I can say it any more succinctly than that, but the evidence is overwhelming for those who pretend to be driven by the evidence. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. And, of course, this means nothing to the top man of science and data in this country, in this state, I should say. That would be Governor Jelly Belly.
Yeah, I mean, he said, honestly, that he's blaming the Republican Senate on if you and your family starve over the Christmas holiday.
So unless the Republican Senate gets a stimulus bill moving in December, Republicans will be putting a big lump of coal in the Christmas stockings of a whole lot of American families.
What a great metaphor.
I can't overstate the implications of this. Without assistance from Congress, 5 weeks from now, there will be no way to replace these benefits for the hundreds of thousands of Illinoisans impacted by these programs.
You know, Illinoisans wouldn't need assistance if he would just reopen everything. Let people live their lives and let the people that are 75 and older, they can shelter in place. And our kids could go back to school, open up everything. And not at 25% capacity or 50% capacity, right? 100% capacity. Because we're not going to get it. And if we get it, we are not going to die from this. So that would be a way to put food on the table for Illinoisans this holiday season, so you don't have a lump of coal in your stocking.
You know, it's right, and that's just, boy, what brilliant writers he must have. That's such a wonderfully campy metaphor. This all starts from the fallacy that we can recover without having an economy. If we just drop ship more money from the feds to the states and localities, if we just prop up government, we can keep the private economy closed. It's the most remarkable thing. How do we figure this out? What can we do? We're doing everything we can. We're doing everything we can except open the private economy that funds all of this.
And that's why people are hurting and losing their livelihoods. And suicide is up. Pritzker tried to poo-poo that a few weeks ago when I brought it up. He's like, well, no, actually, the numbers aren't the same. No, they're not the same. Among teenagers in Cook County, it's up.
And this speaks to a good piece that John Cass wrote, as per usual, as is his wont. Mm-hmm. Restaurateurs enduring the quote-unquote death of a dream. He talked to Jimmy Benakis, who owns Juicy O Restaurant in Downers Grove, but he's run a bunch of big restaurants in the city as well. He said, Jimmy Benakis, you don't see the death of a dream. You don't see the restaurant owner with their heart cut out, losing their home they put up for collateral and all their savings. You don't see that, or the marriage is broken under the stress. You don't see the guilt that comes with the failure or depth of feeling for the employees and their kids that you've watched grow up all their lives and call you Papuli. I guess that's Greek for grandfather.
Sure does.
And a good restaurant is a family, but most people who haven't spent years in a restaurant don't see that. The interesting thing is he's much more charitable to Jelly Belly and the political ruling class than I would be, than he should be, frankly. He said he's not angry at Pritzker or other politicians who shut down businesses. They just don't understand. How could they understand? It would be good if he talked to restaurant owners, actually talked to them. He said you can have outdoor dining. Well, who wants to eat in an igloo? You won't order a $50 piece of fish and eat it in a frozen igloo outside. The pot shops stay open, the liquor stores, the businesses that the state is in, and they shut our businesses. I'm not angry at our leaders. I just want to get on with my life. Well, I mean, Jimmy is a successful guy, and his restaurant probably survives, and he's done well for himself, and he can get on with this. And that's fine, and I'm not blaming him for not blaming them, but I would say that approach of, hey, they just don't understand, these are innocent mistakes, is exactly why we have the political ruling class we have. Rather than holding them for account, to account for what they either are so ignorant and so indifferent that they don't try to achieve an understanding, or that they perfectly do understand that they don't care because they have ulterior motives.
Well, I mean, I tweeted this out yesterday. As they sit in their mansions, and Governor Pritzker's wife and daughter are in a free state where she gets to do the sport that she loves, our children and restaurants are slowly dying. How did we let this happen?
Does he meet with the people?
I mean, honestly, does he leave? Does he have any clue what he's doing to the people of Illinois, to our children? Do you know that sports, football championships, by the way, state playoffs are being played in 33 states this weekend? Not Illinois. Wake up.
Greg and LaGrange.
Hi, good morning, guys. It doesn't matter whether he's doing it on purpose or he's just complete and incompetent. He is an absolute embarrassment. And every time he opens his mouth, it's a war. He tries to declare war against Republicans and blame somebody else. He deflects everything. Mm-hmm. The facts are out there. WirePoints puts him out there. Amy, you ask him about him, and he just acts like he's just oblivious to it. He doesn't care. He's either indifferent or he doesn't care. And this whole high school thing in Illinois, I heard that they were going to play basketball and run up and down the court in the mat with masks on. That's a terrible idea. I don't think you give in to a despot at any level. And either Pritzker knows he's doing this on purpose for some alternative reason, or he's complete incompetent. But he's destroying lives. And it has to be brought to a very simple, concise point every time you speak with this guy. The numbers are this. You are destroying lives.
And I want
how do you square the circle?
Thanks, Greg.
I want you and Dan to hear this, because just listen to it. Because they decided at the last minute to have these briefings virtual this week, just Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, because they're off Thursday and Friday.
Governor, we have a bunch of different questions, but we'll start with one common one that's come from a bunch of people. Amy Jacobson, Rachel Hinton, Jim Leach, WMAY. Why are we doing these briefings virtually this week?
Because you can't ask.
Well, as you know, I asked everybody last week, beginning Friday, as part of our Tier 3 resurgence mitigations, that if they work in an office setting, that if it's at all possible for them to work from home, they should do so. So I've asked my entire staff to do so. We have only a few people in the governor's office right now, but everybody's been working all day and will continue to this week from home.
Oh, so Tier 3 mitigations end at the end of this week. That's what he just said. Because now next week we're going to go back to in-person. See, what somebody on his staff is taking the Thanksgiving holiday off. I don't know which one. And they wanted to be not at the Thompson Center. They wanted to be somewhere else.
So what? I don't care if he does briefings from Ice Station Zebra. So what?
Because you can't ask follow-up questions, Dan. And she just decides which questions to ask.
Okay.
Well, it's annoying. I mean, because you can't ask the questions that you want to ask. And then if they don't answer the question, you can't say, no, you didn't answer my question. Can I have the real answer?
On the COVID relief package thing, since he brought that up, I mean, it is worth noting that Mnuchin is recalling 9 of the 11, or 9 of the 13, I believe, facilities that the Fed set up, with only something like $25 billion of the $450 billion that were allocated actually accessed by state and local governments, the Main Street lending program, the bigger companies. $25 billion of the $450 billion. There also was a balance in the payroll protection program. As successful as that was initially, you know, as usual, the federal government overshoots the demand. This is how good they are at guesstimating supply and demand. Just point of order, since we want to turn the distribution of everything over to the federal government or to governments at every level. The government was having a problem giving away free money, is my point.
Wow.
And one of the few, interestingly, one of the few states and local governments that accessed the municipal facility that the Fed set up was, of course, Illinois, continuing to borrow against tomorrow to pay for yesterday, and that's the only way they can. So maybe that's what Jelly Belly is actually moaning about. Steve in Evanston.
Oh, hi, Dan and Amy. You know, they couldn't pay the bills before. I mean, this state has an incredible debt. The city has an incredible debt. What are his intentions? How's he going to make payroll? I mean, I run a business. I have to make payroll. Does this come into play at all, or is it me?
No, it's you, Steve. You live in the real world, and the politicians in Illinois don't. They just continue to borrow or continue to pay 12% APR on bills that are more than 90 days due, which we've been doing in the billions of dollars worth of bills and hundreds of millions of dollars worth of unnecessary interest payments for generation now. That's absolutely right. Bob in West Chicago.
Hey, this is Bob.
Yeah.
Hi, Bob.
Hey, Bob.
Hey, you guys ever look into what the typical stay for a person who enters a nursing home is at the end of their life?
Yes. I worked at Swedish Retirement Home, volunteered.
It's about 6 months, right?
No, it's, well, the average right now, because of all the, you know, new medicines, it's 1 year from the time you check in until you, you know, transition to a different
check
place.
Out. Yeah.
Well, I didn't want to say that, Dan, but you did.
Yeah.
But yeah, the average is 1 year.
Yeah, that's
at the most.
Average. Most people are there 3, maybe 6 months. And all these people, you know, they get COVID and they're at the end of their life. You know, it accelerates things a bit. But I think looking at things like people dying of COVID in nursing homes without the right context is kind of not exactly right. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well,
yeah.
According to
Thanks
the CDC, 94% of the people that have died from COVID had a comorbidity, and only 6% just died from solely from COVID.
Yeah, I understand. And the nursing home thing, the long-term care facility thing, I don't want to be cavalier with anybody's life and any day of life that anybody has. So to me, it's not being dismissive of those who die in nursing homes. It's saying we know they represent a majority of the deaths.
Right.
So why aren't we doing a better job? Why aren't we taking extraordinary mitigation measures with respect to nursing home residents and not pretending that K through 12 school students are in the same position as nursing home residents? That seems to me the issue. Nancy in Crete.
Hi. First off, I didn't call in for this reason, but good news. My mother, 97, in assisted living, had COVID October 21st. Due to the fact that we were allowed in to take care of her because we were planning her funeral, she survived and is doing fantastically with sister and I taking care of her 24 hours around the clock. And those seniors in assisted living are devastated. They are crying. It's awful. It breaks my heart. But number one, I live in Crete, Illinois. Thank you, Pritzker, for nothing. Shop in Northwest Indiana. I can't move there, Dan. Sorry. But the stores are packed. You cannot get down the aisle. And I doubt everybody is from Northwest Indiana shopping in the stores. Everything. All these people from Chicago coming in. It's just unbelievable. I don't know why people are allowing them to do this. It's just so disheartening. I emailed Holcomb every week with pictures of my mother. Not one response. And people did die in assisted living, and not one of them died from, my mother's friend did not die from COVID. It was from lack of family being there, giving up, and just crying. It's so disheartening.
Mm. Well, thanks for the call, Nancy. And
that's happening. I mean,
glad your mom's okay and you're a good daughter.
There's a 90-year-old woman, Nancy Russell. She decided to choose assisted suicide over facing another lockdown. Mm. She lives in Toronto. She said she declined physically and mentally. The isolation was too much. She couldn't see her loved ones, and her normal routine was disrupted. So she made the painful decision that she wants to, she had assisted suicide.
Well, here again.
Other than
is
facing this prolonged hell.
I mean, it's effectively manslaughter by the state.
I know.
When you take that choice away from a family to be able to see their loved one, who the hell are you to take that choice away? Will and Skokie.
Hey, you know, they're talking about why Biden wants to get on this distribution stuff. It's so they can figure out who the patronage is. You know, he keeps saying Trump doesn't have a plan, but then he wants to know the plan. And, you know, bring that down to Illinois. who's going to get the doses first? What do you want to bet some people on the Bulls and the Bears and all this other stuff are going to get preference over actual people who can get sick from this?
Well,
it's all about the patronage. That's what Democrats are all about.
Thanks for the call. Well, hopefully it'll be the political ruling class first, because
obviously we
want to protect them at all costs. Yeah. Bill in Cape Coral.
Yes, I got the solution to first distribution of all these vaccines during the next BLM, Black Lives Matter, and Antifa peaceful gatherings. You have a table set up with the vaccines. You put Lightfoot with the speaker, the megaphone, and they say, hey, everyone, you get your flat screen and come over here and get your shot. Hey, you over there with the freezer on your back. We know you're on disability. We'll come over and give you the shot over there. Everybody with washers and dryers, line up over here. And when you're done, you go to the table next door. You can make a contribution to Fox's campaign for next election.
All right. All right. Thanks for the call. But by the way, I said Cape Coral like it's local. That's Cape Coral, Florida,
yeah.
Of course.
It's snowing here. Yeah.
Is that right? Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
No, it's snowing here. I know.
Yeah.
Glenn in South Suburbs.
2-3 inches.
Yes, good morning, Dan and Amy. Dan, I wonder if you could just maybe think about changing your moniker for the governor.
Mm-hmm.
Jelly Belly is a really good jelly bean. I would suggest you should call him Governor Jabba the Hutt, the blamer. And the moniker for the mayor, she really should be E.T. Go Home.
All right, thanks for the call, Glenn. Terry in Rogers Park.
I think maybe the Democratic governors are trying to redistribute wealth and also to create more poverty so people are dependent on government.
I think you're onto something, Terry. Thanks for the call. Lee and Hammond, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hi guys. You know, the Chinese were the first ones to actually start the idea of locking down entire cities and now states in our country. And it was the World Health Organization that picked up the ball and ran with this thing and suggested all these different Western countries do this. And this has got nothing to do with health. It's been political from day one. Somebody needs to actually address this and find out why it is that we're allowing a Chinese model for health mitigation here. When it like you say, it's got no, it's the negative effects of this thing are 10 times worse than the virus itself. But yet, we allow this to keep going on and on and on, and it's wrecking the economies of these Western countries. In the meantime, China's doing great. They're back in business from what I've heard.
Thanks for the call, Lee.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Rudy Giuliani was on with Lou Dobbs yesterday addressing the departure or the separation of Sidney Powell from the formal Trump campaign legal team and also assessing the Trump legal team's chances, ultimately at the Supreme Court level, where they want to get.
Well, I think it's because we're pursuing two different theories. Our theory of the case to get to the Supreme Court, now in four places, and it's soon going to be in two others, and there'll be an overall lawsuit, is misconduct of the election by state officials in at least five or six different states, in which the misconduct of the election involve deprivation of constitutional rights for the president. And, for example, in one part of the state, you could fix a ballot, Democrat part. Other part of the state, you couldn't fix a ballot. One part of the state, the ballots were examined. Another part of the state, they didn't care if the ballots were examined. In Pennsylvania, there are 680,000 unexamined ballots that virtually were put in secretly by Democrats alone. That's outrageous. That is misconduct of the election. Elections are supposed to be conducted under the auspices of the laws passed by the legislature. And in fact, they made a mockery of it in Pennsylvania. The only place maybe worse is Michigan, and particularly the city of Detroit. The city of Detroit probably had more voters than it had citizens. I'm exaggerating a bit, but all you have to do is look at statistical data, and you can see that the fraud was rampant and out of control.
That was similar to what Jenna Ellis said on MSNBC as well, one of the other formal members of the Trump legal team, in terms of the belief that they still have the cases based on the constitutional issues that are triggered in places like Pennsylvania to obtain the remedies they seek that would change the outcome of the election. Meanwhile, over on the other side, speaking of MSNBC, Rachel Maddow, she really is ready, obviously, to move on with the Biden administration. Of course she is.
She doesn't want to be bothered with this anymore, Dan.
Except to the extent that she is wanting to have a bit of a reckoning for the Trump legal team for violating these norms she said existed up until the Trump administration with respect to the outcomes of election. She is speaking to NAACP Legal Defense Counsel Sherilyn Ifill, saying this.
We've got this thing that's ended in Michigan in terms of the certification. And I feel like we're sort of now waking up to new realities. One of the things that I'm concerned about is what the Trump administration is going to do during this lame duck period and in the transition to try to set the place on fire, proverbially, as they go. But I think a lot of people are also worried about what you were just describing there, about these tactics, both by the president and by his campaign and by Republicans who support him, that after an election, elections officials are now subject to lobbying, subject to pressure, subject to enticement or threats in a way that should get them to do whatever their party or the party in power or anybody else who has an effect in terms of influencing them can get them to do. I want to go back to that not being a norm in our democracy. I'm worried that now that the Trump administration has set this precedent, it will be. And it feels like the only way to stop that becoming the new normal, at least in Republican politics, is for some people to go to jail for it or to feel like they are going to get in trouble if they get caught doing something like that. Is that the right way to think about it?
And, of course, she got an amen from the NAACP Legal Defense Council. Is that the right way to think about it, sending the attorneys for the president to jail because you don't like the fact that they're pursuing their legal rights, however competently, pursuing their legal rights nonetheless in courts of law? Yeah, interesting. Yeah, it's a real thought experiment.
Not a business. Yeah.
For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Jeffrey Lord, contributing editor to the American Spectator, former aide to Reagan, to Jack Kemp, former CNN commentator, and author of Swamp Wars, Donald Trump and the New American Populism versus the Old Order. Jeffrey Lord, thanks for joining us.
You betcha, Dan. What a time we live in.
Yeah, apparently Rudy and Jenna Ellis and others may need to get their own counsel if Rachel Maddow would have her druthers.
Well, you know, Rachel conveniently ignores something, and I'm talking to you from my home in Pennsylvania, which is dead center in all of this. And just to give you a little quick history, in May of this year, the United States Attorney for the Eastern District of Pennsylvania indicted a Philadelphia Democrat election judge. And why? Because in three different elections, Democratic primaries in most cases, he stood by a voting machine, and when people weren't looking, was going ka-ching, ka-ching, ka-ching for a candidate that he was paid to do that for. You can't make this up. Pennsylvania, Philadelphia in particular, has a very long and very seamy reputation for this kind of thing, and you could see it at work in this election. They didn't let counters, the observers, in, but then they show you these television pictures, and they'll say, oh, well, they're in the room. Well, they're in the room, all right. They're behind bike racks, 6 feet in distance, and at first it was more than that, from the counters station. So you can't possibly see the ballots. I mean, this is just outrageous, and it's standard practice in Philadelphia.
There's a problem here, right? So on the one hand, you say, well, you got to be pragmatic, and if what you're suggesting doesn't rise to the level of altering the outcome, you know, the 83,000 vote margin in Pennsylvania, then it's moot. So, you know, if they fraud it big enough, then you can't get to the threshold of proving fraud that big, and so then they win because you can't clear that threshold. I mean, that's essentially what the Trump campaign is arguing. And even if that's sort of unfair, sounds unfair on its face, the bottom line is still the standard that needs to be met, and they need the issues like taking ballots for 3 days after the election like the curing of ballots in some counties and not others, that they need those issues before the court, but they also need to get a handle on just exactly how many votes we're talking about so they can make that pragmatic argument in their petition for cert as well.
Yes, that's right. And at least as I understand it from Rudy and Jenna and these others, the number is about 682,000 votes in Pennsylvania. And and there was two ways, they're suggesting there's two ways of doing this. One is the kind of thing that we were just talking about, which is standard voter fraud, dead people voting, this kind of thing. And the other is through the machines. And in researching this myself, you know, I find stories in the New York Times, not exactly a right-wing newspaper, that go back to 2006. U.S. investigates voting machines, Venezuela ties. That's over a decade ago. And it goes into chapter and verse on this kind of thing. And, this is a real serious problem here. And they've had problems with these Dominion machines, Dominion being the name of the company, in one election after another, South Carolina. I mean, on and on. I could go through a whole list here.
Right.
But this evidence needs to get in front of a judge and eventually lead its way to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the clock's ticking.
Yes, you're absolutely right. I mean, and I think this is where, I mean, either Sidney Powell, who has a pretty good reputation, either she's got the goods or not. And I know she said the other day when she was on with Maria Bartiromo on Fox, I don't say things I can't prove. So
yeah,
we've got to see.
Yeah, but so the problem is, so far she has been saying things she can't prove. And I'm not even talking about Dominion voting systems or Smartmatic. I'm talking about making assertions like Brian Kemp accepted bribes from Dominion voting system. I mean, it's just that's not something a formal federal prosecutor says in public without the evidence at the ready to connect the dots. I mean, she's been I can see that she's a serious person and all those things, but she's been really reckless the last week or so.
Well, even Rush Limbaugh has expressed some concern here. And, you know, the bottom line for somebody like Sidney Powell is, you know, if you've got a really good reputation, you don't want to do anything that's going to, you know, cast doubt on that. And until she comes up with this evidence, of which she says she has tons of, and puts it out there, I mean, there's going to be a question. There's just no question about that.
Yeah, and I mean, how did you interpret the formal separation, the need to issue a statement without context that just says she's doing her thing, we're doing our thing? That's, you know, 72 hours after a press conference where they were doing their things together.
Yeah, I frankly was a little baffled by this. I mean, there has to be something going on, and I assume we will eventually find it out. What it is, I couldn't begin to tell you. I just know that, you know, that the Trump campaign, I along with others, get these invitations to be on briefing calls in the late afternoon. And, you know, no indication there about the split.
Do you have any doubt that if Trump exhausts his legal options, particularly with respect to the constitutional issues that Giuliani and company are pursuing, that he will acquiesce and there will be a peaceful, orderly transition of power?
No, I don't have any doubt about that. It wouldn't surprise me if he in essence concedes and announces for president in 2024 in the same breath.
Maybe with a new running mate, Nikki Haley, who knows? But in your heart of hearts, I mean, do you think that the votes are really there? What, Biden's got 78 million . Trump has 73.8 million votes. Do you think that the votes are there in those swing states to overturn this election?
I think it's possible. Yes, I do. And again, the two methods of doing it, just the standard voter fraud and then the combination with Dominion and the machines, I do think that's a possibility. And one other curious thing in Philadelphia, there's a Republican voting commissioner who has been outspoken and said there's no problem. And yet, in doing my research, I find out that he was sharply criticized, this was a year ago or so, by a city ethics official or something in Philadelphia because he had awarded a contract to a voting system company. It wasn't Dominion, it was another one. And lo and behold, he had campaign contributions from them.
Sounds very Chicago-like.
Yeah. Chicago, Philadelphia, Detroit, what's the difference, right?
What's your sense as you see some Republicans folding up their tents for Trump and saying, you know, it's time for him to concede and move on? Obviously, you have the Georgia Senate runoff and that all eyes will be on that through November 5th and then come what may. But assuming that Trump does not overturn the results, where does the Republican Party go in a Biden administration? Let's say it has a Senate majority.
Well, I do think that Donald Trump continued a trend that my old boss Ronald Reagan began, which is in essence making the Republican Party a blue-collar workers' party, if you will. And I think that trend is going to continue no matter who emerges as a potential candidate other than Donald Trump in 2024. The party itself has continued this change from the Reagan era, which I find all to the good here. And so everybody's going to have to adapt as best they can. But they certainly shouldn't be giving up the ghost at this point. We need to get to the bottom of this because this is seriously about the integrity of the American election system. And if we lose faith in that, we're in big trouble.
He is Jeffrey Lohr, contributing editor to the American Spectator, former aide to Ronald Reagan, Jack Kemp, former CNN commentator, and author of Swamp Wars, Donald Trump and the New American Populism versus the Old Order. Jeffrey Lohr, thanks for joining us.
You bet. Anytime. Happy Thanksgiving.
You too. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Dan and Amy, we talked about this in the run-up to the election. We talked about it a year and a half ago, more than that, when Dennis Prager and Robert Epstein, a Harvard-trained psychologist, discussed before a Senate subcommittee the issue of censorship by the big tech companies, including Google. And at that hearing, you'll recall, in July of 2019, Robert Epstein suggested that Google had moved between 2.5 and 10 million votes in the 2016 election, and that if they worked together, Google with Facebook and Twitter, they could move as many as 20 million votes in the 2020 election. Well, nothing was really done with respect to Google and Facebook, Twitter, the big tech companies, in advance of November 3rd. And so Robert Epstein was on with Tucker Carlson last night to talk about his research he conducted in the 2020 election in this topic area of big tech bias and manipulation. And here's what he suggests Google was able to accomplish at minimum on November 3rd.
Well, a couple of things that we've looked at so far. First of all, we had 733 field agents in three key swing states this year, Arizona, North Carolina, and Florida. And we preserved more than 500,000 ephemeral experiences. That's a lot. That's about 30 times more data than we got in 2016. And we're finding a couple of things that are pretty clear. Number one is that Google's search results were strongly biased in favor of liberals and Democrats. This was not true on Bing or Yahoo. The bias was being shown to pretty much every demographic group we looked at, including conservatives. So, in fact, conservatives got slightly more liberal bias in their search results than liberals did. How do you account for that? And then we also found what seems to be a smoking gun. That is, we found a period of days when the vote reminder on Google's homepage was being sent only to liberals. Not one of our conservative field agents received a vote reminder during those days. The good news is, on that fourth day that we were monitoring, we went public with some of our findings, and Google backed off. They literally shut off that manipulation that night. And so for 4 days before the election, they were showing vote reminders to everyone, finally.
And so the impact?
Imagine the effect. What if you measured the effect of this manipulation had on the outcome of the election?
Well, there are multiple manipulations here. We were also monitoring YouTube this time and Facebook and Bing and Yahoo. The bottom line at the moment is that these manipulations, the ones that we've so far quantified, could easily have shifted at least 6 million votes in just one direction. That's the bare minimum at this point that I'm confident of. The maximum, we haven't even begun to estimate that yet because we have so much data to look at.
6 million votes minimum. Obviously, that's more than this spread, in at least if you just focus on particular states that are being litigated right now. And again, I think part of this is, what are we supposed to do as policymakers exactly? How do we clip their wings legitimately within the constraints of the Constitution? Is talking about their Section 230 protections, is that enough? But this is going to be a discussion that continues on into the next Congress and the next several years as Google and these big tech companies actually undermine the credibility of the American electoral system, too.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Well, over the last couple of months, you've had real progress in terms of Middle East peace with these normalization deals that have been struck between Israel and Bahrain, Israel, United Arab Emirates, Israel, and Sudan, brokered by the Trump administration at part. And there was a report that Secretary of State Mike Pompeo took part in a secret meeting this week between Israeli PM Benjamin Netanyahu, Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, the first known summit between Israel and Saudi Arabia. The leaders, this is reporting the Wall Street Journal, discussed several issues during the meeting on Sunday, including normalizing ties, addressing Iran, a shared enemy of the two nations. Lasted a couple of hours. Pompeo tweeted out pictures of his meeting with the Crown Prince, and also a visit to Israeli settlement in the West Bank. So that would indicate perhaps some real serious progress in normalization of relations between Saudi Arabia and Israel, except a Saudi Arabian foreign minister denied the meeting took place, saying, "I've seen press reports about a purported meeting between the Crown Prince and Israeli officials during the recent trip by Secretary Pompeo. No such meeting occurred. The only officials present were American and Saudi," said Prince Faisal bin Farhan al Saud on Twitter yesterday. So let's see if we can get some clarification on this apparent controversy about what did or didn't happen. To help us with that, we're pleased to be joined by Fahad Nazir, who is the spokesperson for the Embassy of Saudi Arabia in Washington, D.C. Mr. Nazir, a pleasure to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me on.
So did this meeting occur or did it not occur?
So Prince Faisal's statement was unequivocal and it was very clear. And he was there at the meeting himself and he said no such meeting occurred. Not only that, but he issued an additional clarification to a Saudi media outlet, Al Arabiya, also yesterday, saying that he personally received and bid farewell to Secretary of State Pompeo in the airport in Neom and attended the meeting with the Crown Prince, and there were no Israelis present.
How did the Wall Street Journal and other outlets get it so wrong, do you think?
You know, I'm not sure, but I think it's important not to lose track of the bigger picture. And the big picture says that the kingdom's position on the Israeli-Palestinian dispute has been consistent for many years. In fact, it was the late King Abdullah who introduced the Arab Peace Initiative at the Arab Summit in Beirut all the way back in 2002. The initiative was endorsed by all 22 member states of the Arab League, and it essentially offers Israel normalization with all of these nations in return for a just and comprehensive peace agreement between Israelis and Palestinians based on a two-state solution. that offer is still on the table, and we hope that the Israelis and Palestinians go back to the negotiating table, because this core dispute between the two peoples and two nations really has been the cause of so much pain and suffering in the region for many years.
Does that mean that MBS would be opposed to a meeting with Bibi, or is that something that it's just not appropriate at this time?
Yeah, we've made it clear that the core dispute has to be resolved. As I said, it's been the cause of so much suffering for both Palestinians and Israelis over decades. Not only that, but it has also allowed terrorist groups like Al-Qaeda, ISIS, and Hezbollah to recruit followers and to wreak havoc across the region and beyond. So it's very important that for the region, for the Middle East to enjoy any peace and stability, this core issue, this core dispute has to be resolved. And once that is done, as we have said and we have been saying for decades now, there really is no reason why Israel cannot have normal relations with the rest of the region.
Now, a number of mainstream media outlets are saying that Mike Pompeo and the Crown Prince met because of a possible military attack on Iran.
No, I don't have any information about that. But what I will say about U.S.-Saudi relations is they are longstanding. In fact, this past February 14th marked the 75th anniversary of the first meeting between the late King Abdulaziz Al Saud, the founder of modern-day Saudi Arabia, and the late President Franklin Delano Roosevelt aboard the USS Quincy in the Suez Canal. And since that time, in those 75 years, the relationship has continued to broaden and to strengthen and to deepen on multiple levels. I think in many ways it's multidimensional. And it has continued to strengthen and to deepen under both Democratic and Republican administrations, I might add.
So how does the Crown Prince receive those normalization deals that have been struck between Israel and Bahrain and United Arab Emirates and Sudan?
Well, obviously, these countries are sovereign nations. They made decisions based on what is best for their national security interests. We've made our position very clear. At the same time, any measures or moves towards diffusing and reducing tensions in the regions are positive developments.
What about the prospect of a renewed Iranian nuclear deal if you have a Biden administration coming in? With Iran seeking nuclearization, seeking to be the hegemon in that region, how concerned is Saudi Arabia about potentially a Biden administration resuscitating the Obama administration policies?
Well, Iran has sought to destabilize the entire Middle East and provoke conflict for the past 40 years. It has violated practically every law, convention, and norm of the international community. It has supported militant groups around the world and backed terrorist attacks in places as varied as Saudi Arabia, Lebanon, Kuwait, Iraq, Argentina, France, Germany. Even here in the United States, in the capital in Washington, they tried to assassinate our previous ambassador a few years ago. So it is the leading state sponsor of terrorism. We essentially did back the JCPOA, but we've always had reservations about the sunset clauses. We had reservations and concerns about Iran's ballistic missile program, and we definitely have and continue to have reservations and serious concerns about its malign activities in the region. So any future negotiations, we hope that they will take all of these points into account, because they are linked to, they should be linked certainly to any negotiations about the nuclear file.
What would it mean for the region if the preconditions you said were met by Israel and Israel and Saudi Arabia did establish official relations? What would that mean for the region going forward?
Well, as I said, I think it would certainly reduce tensions in the region. The score dispute has been the source of a lot of pain and suffering. And Israel does have a lot to offer. It has thriving sectors in security, in defense, in agriculture. They're leaders in technology when it comes to water preservation and water desalination. There's obviously a lot of history there in Israel and in Palestine, so they have a thriving, or should have a thriving, tourism industry and sector. So once, as I said, once that core dispute is resolved between Israelis and Palestinians, there really is, you know, the sky's the limit, as they say.
Hmm. And your assessment of the Trump administration and the relationship that Saudi Arabian government enjoyed with the Trump administration during his first term.
Right. So Saudi Arabia has and continues to have excellent relations with the current administration. I think President Trump and his administration appreciates the constructive role that Saudi Arabia has played in pushing back against terrorist groups like ISIS and Al-Qaeda. I think it appreciates the role that it has played in pushing back against Iran and its malign activities in the region. It also appreciates the role that Saudi Arabia has played in stabilizing global energy markets. So as I said, Saudi Arabia and the United States have had a longstanding relationship that has endured for many, many good reasons. There's a political dimension, there's a security dimension, there's a military dimension between the two countries. People seem to forget that Saudi and U.S. forces have fought two wars side by side. Once back in 1990 when we expelled the invading troops of Saddam Hussein from Kuwait, and then again more recently in 2015 when again Saudi and U.S. troops and forces expelled the terrorist group known as ISIS from Syria and Iraq. So this is a great relationship that has endured for a long time, and we certainly look forward to it continuing well into the future.
Fahad Nazir, spokesperson for the Embassy of Saudi Arabia in Washington, D.C. Mr. Nazir, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you. My pleasure.
He joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, and I've got some good news for Thanksgiving.
What?
Yeah, good news. Happy news. The Farm Bureau's 35th annual survey indicates that the average cost of this year's Thanksgiving feast for 10, if you're allowed to have 10, depending on where you live, remains affordable. $46.90. That's less than $5 a person. It's a $2 decrease or 4% from last year's average of $48.91. Thanksgiving is becoming more affordable. Isn't that exciting?
Well, probably because people are buying smaller turkeys because we're not going to have as many people.
No. The centerpiece on most Thanksgiving tables, the turkey, costs less than last year, $19.39 for a 16-pound bird. I didn't know that turkeys were that inexpensive.
Have you ever cooked Thanksgiving dinner?
No.
I can't even believe I'm asking.
Have I ever cooked dinner?
Have you ever? Have you ever, and be honest, have you ever used your oven or your stove in all the years that you've lived in your condo there?
I have heated up a pizza a couple times.
Have you ever used the stove, Dan? Have you ever boiled water or made pasta or anything? Or even ramen noodles?
No.
SpaghettiOs?
Nope, nothing.
Ravioli? Okay. Wow. Have you, have you used your microwave oven?
For like tea.
Have you asked?
For my afternoon high tea.
Uh-huh. Oh, that's right, high tea.
Right.
And what about your dishwasher?
That's why I have a cleaning person that, washes dishes.
Oh, you're such a snob. Do you wash your own laundry?
Yeah, I do, actually.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, but I got a unit right there. It's pretty turnkey. It's pretty simple. Sometimes Hayek does it for me.
Oh, that's right. He's
we
so
trade
advanced.
Off. So there's that. So that's important. Just so you know, I don't know. It's every little bit helps in these austere times. And then there's this from a couple of social workers writing in Baltimore Sun. A guide to surviving the holidays during the pandemic. And if you weren't feeling suicidal before reading this, you'll feel suicidal after reading it. There's no question about that.
I want to hear this.
And they want these people to replace police officers? I don't think so. Make a decision about virtual or in person. If in person, follow safety rules, blah, blah, blah.
Oh, my God. Wait, do I have to wash my hands? Does this involve me washing my hands? I just want to know.
No, but there are other similarly insightful pieces of advice. Like if you choose a video conference, keep in mind not everyone can talk at once, so try to create a structure that will involve everyone. Don't leave crazy Uncle Joe out of the conversation. Also difficult to have separate conversations on video conference. This limits the common safety valve of getting away from the people who distress you and spending time with the people you enjoy most. What if everyone distresses me? Plan separate conversations with these people. unless your social style is as a group is enjoyably argumentative, try to set aside differences. Focus on what you share rather than on what divides you.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Are you writing all this down?
Yeah, I am. Oh, wait.
When you feel a surge of disappointment or anger, take a deep breath, bite your tongue. Open expression of these kinds of feelings generally just make things worse. Yeah. Keep in mind the holidays don't have to be perfect. Good enough as well. Good enough. And for that matter, terrible blunders like a dropped turkey sometimes make for the best family memories. And if you are having a psychiatric crisis, like after reading this, you can call a number that they provide, Phyllis Meyerson and Michael Friedman. And please, for the love of God, don't have Thanksgiving dinner with Phyllis Meyerson or Michael Friedman, the authors of this column.
Oh my God.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.